to get rid of your fear, phobia, stress, or anxiety? How to burst your fear and transform your life? Welcome to Fear Busters Show, presented by Lauren Rosenberg, fear and phobia relief expert and author of How to Move Forward When the Unthinkable Happens. You are listening to UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio with Lauren Rosenberg. www.fear-busters.com.
Hi, welcome back to UK House Radio. I'm Lauren Rosenberg, Fear Buster Show, and today we have a special guest, Dipti, talking about fear of death. Welcome.
Hello, Lauren. Thank you for asking me.
So just can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do? And then we're going to talk about the fear of death. Maybe people, especially now with the pandemic, it could be that people are actually scared of life and scared of losing loved ones. So yes,
it's a very, very interesting time that we're in at the moment. But yes, I'm Dipti Tate. I am a solution-focused hypnotherapist. Also, I'm a grief author. So I've written my first book called Good Grief, and I'm currently writing my second book called Planet Grief.
So Dipti, the Good Grief, where can we find the book? And could you tell listeners a little bit more about the book and how you got to write the book? We both have something, unfortunately, in common, is losing loved ones. Yeah. I mean, it's slightly different. You lost your parents. I lost my eldest daughter. But we both felt the need of writing a book. How did you get to decide to write a book and why?
Probably the same reason you did, because we wanted to write our thoughts out of our head, you know, and it was a cathartic process for me. And I don't know about you, but I didn't start writing my book thinking I was wanting to help anyone else. It was mainly for me to get help. And it just so happened that the book then ended up being published and then helping others, which was a bonus, you know.
That's so quite interesting, because I originally wrote the book because it wasn't for me to help myself. It was more like, first of all, I wanted to put the story down into a piece of paper, but it was to help my family. I thought, as it's written, they're going to have to, well, some of my family read it and did the editing, so they had to keep reading it. So as they kept on reading it, I thought it would be a self-help therapy by having to read the story again and again, you know, to edit it. And so indirectly, that was my idea, in a way, of putting first all the details down, because my youngest daughters didn't know everything that happened because they weren't always there at the hospital. So I wanted to make sure that they know what happened, but in a story, so that it will be, as hard as it is for them to read it, I wanted them to sort of have something there. But also I felt that it was important for people to know what tools helped me and helped my family, and what I use in order to get to where we are now. So that's an interesting that was the idea for me to get the book. And it's but for you, it was more like first thing of putting things down and helping yourself in that sense. So
yes, and also with you, I'm so amazed that as a mother of losing, you know, a child, I have no idea what that would feel like. And I think, I mean, we can't compare grief and say your grief is greater than my grief.
Because, well, any grief.
But grief is grief, isn't it?
You know, any grief, even if you lose a pet. You know, I mean, unfortunately, there were fireworks a few weeks ago, and the mum wrote a post on Facebook saying that my special needs child was in tears, in a little rabbit, had a heart attack because of fireworks. It is any grief. I think whoever it is, and even if it's an animal, it has an impact on our life because we're just human being. So, and I like to think, and I don't know about you, but I like to think that any grief has their own story, and everyone, because we're all different, we're all going to react differently. Yes. But it's important to know that there are different tools out there and people that can help and support, and it's noticing when you need the help and how you can help yourself. And
And really knowing that you are not alone, you know, that's the main message I think that I want to share with people, is that people tend to think that their grief is their grief and no one else can feel as bad as they do at that moment. But actually, we are human beings, we have a kind of collective grief. So even though we might not have lost that same relationship, but we all know what it feels like to lose in our own personal story. And again, you're right, it's totally individually story related. And that's why I love the way you shared your story with your family. So we all know how metaphors work, you know, because metaphors are a lovely way of maybe giving some information without it being too direct. And it is an indirect way of helping somebody process, you know, appropriately.
And you're right. And you're also very right to say, I know personally that when my daughter passed away, afterwards, some parents came up to me and say, you know, my son or my daughter has been so affected by it. So it's not just the person who's lost a loved one, it's also, like you said, you know, the people who know that person, and sometimes they can have even in a way a worse reaction because they haven't got that support because they don't even expect it. And I know that some people can really feel down and depressed, and you know, there has been cases of a student in a classroom who unfortunately passed away, and the whole class, the whole students don't know how to deal with it, and then gradually they will indirectly carry the grief without knowing, and it won't be dealt with until suddenly they really feel down and depressed or feeling really low. So you're right, it can affect anyone, and especially now, even I think now with the pandemic, it could even be grief for job. I mean, I was listening to somebody who's for 20 years a pilot, and now he can't work, and you know, oh, that was a career, that was what he learned, and he's, you can also grieve from a job because this is your life, this is what you wanted to do, and so it's totally right. There's no wrong, I think there's no right or wrong of how people grieve and what people grieve about.
And I think you're right, because that's the whole point of planet grief. Good grief was about death and loss in that way. Planet grief is much more general about how you can even grieve in the good times, not just the bad times, and how, you know, grief doesn't come in a nice, cute little package that you can say, aha, there is grief. Okay, now let me deal with it. It doesn't do that. It comes in so many incredibly subtle, but also incredibly powerful ways. And it's not a linear process. It's like a big, huge mess, you know. And so fear is one of the states of grief. Mm-hmm. And you would see why it makes sense to be fearful, because if, you know, you've lost something that is dear to you, that you've held important, perhaps it could be a relationship, it could be a job, it could be a house, it could be a location, it could be a pet, it could be something that you've loved and you've invested in, basically. Once you've lost that, then at some level, your identity is also shaken up, because then, now who are you without that in your life? You know,
it's a big change. I think the worst thing is also because when it's unexpected, when you don't expect it at all, and it just suddenly hits you, then that is when it's just like it's a big shock, and you just can't really digest it and process it, and it takes time.
And even when you have, you know, even when you have got privy to the fact that this is coming, you know, something is, and obviously with the pandemic, that was unexpected. But for example, if, you know, you have a parent who's had a long-term illness, you know, and you know eventually that, you know, they are going downhill and you've had maybe years to deal with it, and then they do die, people have the assumption that, oh, well, at least I knew about it, so it must be okay. But no, it's not okay.
It's not okay. Sometimes it's even worse because it's almost like you've been expecting it and you don't know. And I think it can be worse because you get so tired and so exhausted energy wise because you may have looked after the person for mm-hmm. so long, and then suddenly the person is no longer there. So not only you don't have the person, but you have to rearrange your whole timetable, your whole day-to-day life, because you were concentrating all the time looking and helping that person.
Yeah, because your identity has changed yes. again, hasn't it? And this level of freedom that you might have, yes, on some level it might be a relief, but on other levels it will be, well, what do I do now? What is my purpose now? I mean, this is the same as when my dad passed away, because when I was 3 years old, he had his first heart attack. And every couple of years, till I was 22, he had a heart attack. And he had 11 heart attacks in his life. So I grew up with my dad having heart attacks. This was normal. Every time he went into hospital, people would be like, oh, your dad's had a heart attack. And I would just be like, almost like he's had a cold, you know. Yeah. It was that normal to me to get in an ambulance with him, to sit and watch the heart rate monitor go up and down, to be in the blue light scenario, to be in the hospital with resus pads. That was so normal to me from a small child. It was normal. So when he went into hospital the last time, this time he wasn't in the heart ward. He wasn't in the coronary care unit or in intensive care because of heart. He went in because he had leukemia. And so I was really confused. I was like, what even is leukemia? What does that even mean? And somebody said, oh, that's cancer. And I was like, oh, but my dad doesn't have cancer. He's going to die of a heart attack. You know, that's how he's going to die.
Yeah, because deep down you created that belief. Because
and of course he was going to die of a heart attack, because that was the way it was going to go. He didn't. He died of leukemia. And then also I was so used to him coming back out of hospital. They'd be like, oh, this was a big one. This was close. But he always came home again.
He always bounced back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I didn't actually think he was going to die. I thought he was immortal, you know. So when he died, oh my gosh, that was the biggest shock. One, he didn't die of a heart attack. And two, he died of something that I'd never even heard of. And what do you mean he's not ever coming back home again?
Yeah, this is a shock. And you also, you know, I'm sorry that it happened. But, you know, you also said that grief is, it comes and goes. Like people think that when you laugh and you're happy and that you've over it. And in fact, once we had, I heard a therapist saying, it's been X amount of years, but now you should have gone over it. And I was like,
no.
Okay, let me run away from that person, because if that's how they're thinking like that, it's not something that you get over it. It is a major, major change in your life, and you can't change that. That is, you can't change it. But what you can do is digest as much as you can the news and go beyond that and use tools that you and I know that to help. The book that you've written, when is it going to come out?
2021
October. Would you talk about how to help yourself, or what? Just tell me a bit more about the book. I'm intrigued.
It's a little bit like yours, actually, because there's many, many stories in the book. So because we know how stories are powerful. So there are there's a lot of neuroscience in the book, as well as stories to accompany the neuroscience, as well as a little bit of my experiences, as well as a hypnotherapist and, you know, client case studies and things like that. So it's a mixture. The first book I wrote, just to give you context of how different this book is, was 16,000 words, and it's, you know, quite a skinny thing. This one is 75,000 words. So, you know, it's a big old book. So it's something for you to kind of take your time over, I guess. But, you know, you talked about earlier, just a minute ago, about you can't just get over it, and time is not a healer. That is a massive myth.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I hate when people come up to you and say, "Oh, time is a healer," and once you've done the first birthday without your daughter, it'll get better. And then the first Christmas, first Hanukkah, whatever festival you celebrate, and it's giving the wrong idea, because what if it doesn't get better? What if you still feel like this when you have another birthday? And I totally agree with you. Time is not, time is just time. It's not, the difference is, it's like, okay, it's the first time you're doing something different. And then the second time you're doing it again different. But I don't know about you, but for us, birthdays now are even more something special, and we make even a bigger party or bigger celebration. And we just really spend, like, instead of doing maybe one day, we just like do a weekend we just make a special thing because we know how important it is to celebrate. But definitely, I mean, I don't know how you feel, but definitely I totally agree with you with time. I think it's a completely wrong idea of telling somebody who lost someone, saying, you know, time is a healer and it will help. And don't agree with that at all.
It only is a healer depending on what you do in the time or how you process in the time. That then, you know, is the key. Time is not a healer when you just do the same or don't do anything or deny it or push it away. Then actually time becomes worse, because if you then believe time is a healer, then as you say, in 10 years' time, you're still falling to pieces on the day of the birthday or the day of the death day, whatever it is, you then feel bad. You feel like you failed even more because time should have been healing. So what is wrong with me?
Yeah.
I always describe grief as putting a big lump of sugar inside a cup of coffee. So as soon as you drop the sugar lump in the coffee, it starts to dissolve. And eventually, time, with a bit of stirring, so we need to have the stirring effect going on, because if we don't stir the coffee, all of that sugar will fall to the bottom and it will still be sort of bitter at the top, and then it will be very, very sweet at the bottom. So we want to be able to understand that we need to do something, the action, to make it equalized and balanced. But then eventually the coffee will be sweet, and then you can never remove that sugar cube again. It's sweet now. So that's how I describe grief. You know, we have got this dissolved into our fibers, into our being, into our cells, and we are sweetened with grief. Now, interesting choice of words when I say sweetened with grief, because I've got to a point in my life, which is probably, you know, after I've processed and looked back and thought about things and, you know, done a lot of self-inquiry and also talked to many other people, I feel that grief has actually helped me find some resources and strengths inside me that I never ever knew I had.
And yes, I agree. It's when you do the work on yourself, and then obviously it takes time, and you process in different stages of grief, but you do find some resilience, and you do find, and I know that one of my daughter said that you know, if I manage to deal with this, then I can deal with anything.
Yeah.
And it's true, because this is a massive, it's just nothing worse than that can happen, losing your sister. So then, yeah, you sort of take over, and you take over some control, and then you sort of digest it as much as you can, digest the news, but you just deal with, we can't change it. You can't change that, but you can change how you react to it and how you process it. And it's true. And there is so many different, I think, wrong ideas about grief. That people think, oh, you need to get over it, or time is a healer. But it's not. It's like you say, it's a transformation. Things have changed unexpectedly sometimes. Sometimes, even like you said, it could be a long time, and then suddenly it happens, and this is what we need to adjust, because there's nothing else. We can't go back and change something. It has changed without our willingness. We didn't want that, and that's what happened. So it's forcing us to take the resources, like you said, to make you more resilient, stronger. And I don't know how, when you became a hypnotherapist, or what took you in here. Was it before losing your dad, or?
No, so I was only young when I lost my dad. I was in my 20s, so 22. I actually worked in the TV industry then. I was at the BBC. So very different, very, very different career to what
I very stressful.
It was very, very 24-hour, definitely. And, you know, TV was very, very important, and we were all very important, you know, so it was quite an egotistical environment to be in. So that's where I sort of started my career. And then when my dad passed away, that was my first, you know, direct loss that I'd ever faced. Interestingly enough, it was in between, because obviously I was at the BBC and I worked in post-production. So I work quite closely with, you know, quite a lot of program makers and things. And my dad passed away in between Jill Dando. And I don't know if you remember Jill Dando, but she was a presenter for Holiday and Watchdog. And I used to work with her. And so she died, my dad died, and then Princess Diana died. So in between, that I was kind of sandwiched in between. Even though I didn't really, obviously, I didn't know Princess Diana, but she was the people's princess, and I loved her. And
everybody loved her, yeah.
Yeah, and I loved Orlando, you know, and then I also loved my dad. So I had all these
like
kind of
three people in one go.
Yeah, very, very quick succession of like, oh, there's this thing called death, you know, and it's really affecting me. And I remember sitting at my desk one day, and just, it all just exploded in my head, like a bomb went off in my head. And I just didn't know what had happened to me. I was just in some kind of unfamiliar state, and I couldn't help it. I couldn't stop it. It was just there. And my boss was amazing at the time, and she sent me home basically. And she said, you know, don't come back. You know, you are grieving. And, you know, this, she said, I wondered when you'd be, when this would come out for you, because she knew my dad had died, but I'd obviously just put it in some kind of box and like try to hammer some nails in, you know, so nothing would come out. But I think the collective grief in Television Centre from Diana and Jill, it brought this out for me.
It's too much.
Yeah. And that's when I suddenly thought, okay, I think I might be going mad. I'm having a breakdown. I'm in my 20s. We don't really do that, but here we go. Let's see what this is all about. And then my family weren't very, I mean, they're lovely, but they weren't really aware. They weren't really aware of my emotional needs, I guess. In an Indian way, my grandmother, she, in her belief system, they do, you know, sort of 7-14 days of wailing. So when somebody has died, everybody who you don't even know come round the house, and they all sit around and they really wail. And I remember thinking, when my dad passed away and I had a lounge full of, I don't know, 24 people who are, maybe I've seen them once, maybe I've never seen them before, and they're all crying because my dad has died. And I remember thinking, who even are you guys? You know, and why are you crying? What is wrong with you guys? And why am I having to make tea for you? And
yeah, it's hard to understand that somebody else will react like this when you just,
I was so angry. And that was my grandma's traditional cultural way of processing grief. And that's what they did. But it wasn't my way. So then, because we'd had the wailing, she sort of made the assumption, and so did my mum, that, oh, we should all be okay now. We've done that. We're good. I wasn't good. And so I had no one I could talk to, really. So that's when I started writing my thoughts down in what I had as grief diaries at the time. And then I started to realize there were some patterns happening here. So sometimes I'd feel incredibly lonely. Sometimes I'd feel really scared. Sometimes I'd feel really, really sad. Sometimes I'd feel so, so angry. Other times I'd feel super guilty. So I categorized all of these feelings into each diary. So whenever I would feel that emotion or a combination of those emotions, I would write in those diaries. So in the end, I had about seven, eight diaries full of, I don't know, thoughts or feelings or whatever it was.
And it's a good idea that you, not everybody would think about that, but it's a good idea that, especially if you're feeling lonely, to put it down, not to sort of keep everything inside you. So you did, yeah.
Yeah, so, and so that's where the first book came from, was actually organizing those diaries into something, you know, sensible. But I'm an only child as well, so I'm used to loneliness. Loneliness isn't something that is a problem for me because I don't have brothers and sisters. You know, I'm the oldest cousin out of all of us. So I was, for about 5 or 6 years in my life, I was the only child in the family.
It's also hard because you can't share it with any siblings, anyone.
I wasn't used to having that anyway, so it wasn't like I knew what that felt like. So I was always used to being on my own and sorting myself out and self-soothing. That was quite a skill from an early age, because when you're an only child, that's kind of what you have to do, really. So
yeah, you're mixing more with adults, and you have to. Yeah, you're feeling more lonely, and you just have to just get on with things and finding your own solutions in certain ways.
There's no word for loneliness when you're an only child. You don't feel lonely.
Yeah, because you don't know anything else.
You don't know. Yeah, you don't. Honestly, I didn't understand. Even now, I have to really be mindful of what loneliness might mean or feel like to somebody else, because I don't feel it. I can't feel it. But when I felt grief, I felt loneliness. That's the first time I felt loneliness. So as a kid, I never felt lonely because I had a really active imagination and imaginary friends and, you know, and all of this. So, but when I felt grief, loneliness from grief, that was a really alien feeling.
Yeah, because this is so when did you get into hypnotherapy? What made you
That was the original question, and I
that's okay.
So then when my mum was diagnosed with cancer, I had then already had my children, so I'd left the TV industry because then now I was a mother and you can't have two 24-hour industries running at the same time. So I decided to leave TV to be a mum, a full-time mum.
That's a full-time job anyway. I was there 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Exactly. So obviously they took priority. The boys took priority. Then they kind of got into school age as my mum was passing away. And then I thought, you know, I really want to do something different with my life, and this is an opportunity because I've had a career break now to think about what else I could do. And then I was thinking about, I started actually training as a massage therapist. So I got my qualifications to be a massage therapist, and I had a really nice, in London, I had a good little business going, you know, in between the children going to school. I used to do my massage and it was really good. And then I was doing quite a lot of massage. I got quite a good business. But then I got RSI in my shoulder, repetitive strain injury. And I thought, actually, this is probably not very good for my physical. You can't see me on the radio, but I'm only fine.
It does take. I know that I have good friends who do massage or acupuncture, and after many years of practicing, they do complain about physical pain because they use their own body to help other people. And I think it's those type of career, they have a limitation in how long. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of push to look into what else can I do without having damaging my body in that sense.
And so that's why I had to stop because of that. I'm only 5 foot. So I'm, you know, quite small and petite. I'm like size 8 and 5 foot. So this is very, you know, especially when everyone wants deep tissue massage. So then I thought, well, I like the idea of having clients. I like the idea of therapy. Also, I was really into the brain and how the brain worked. So I always used to really watch programs about how the brain worked, and I read books about the brain, and I really should have gone into neuroscience, but I didn't. Anyway, and then I thought, well, hang on, how can I link the brain and therapy together? And then I thought, well, maybe hypnotherapy is a good idea. And I'm really fascinated by the subconscious mind. And so then I began looking for a school. And it, you know, when something is right for you, it just falls into place. And almost like you don't have to try hard, things just happen. That's how it was for me, where it just happened. This just happened to be exactly the right time. That person exactly was the right person, and I spoke to the right, you know, and everything just happened seamlessly like magic. And that was in 2012. And now we're at 2020, so that was 8 years ago. It's all continued to flow exactly the same way.
So very good.
I know, it's a message to me to say that, you know, I'm constantly in flow with it, and you know, it's obviously my pathway and, you know, my purpose.
Do you specialize in any field, or you'll see any client depending on what they're suffering from?
I don't specialize, but I do have preferences, but I don't specialize. I'm very, I'm a general hypnotherapist. But I do teach hypnotherapy now. So I lecture on grief, obviously, because I suppose in that way, that's a speciality because of my books. I lecture on grief, I lecture on pain, and I also lecture on sort of getting yourself out there, so branding and PR.
Okay, but the brain, I mean, it's fascinating. It's I don't think we even know a quarter of what our brain can even do. And many years, probably in different centuries, we'll even know even more about it. But there's so much that we can do, and so much that you can access to change and make such a transformation in people's life. I don't use hypnotherapy yet, but I think it's fascinating that just accessing the subconscious mind and making so many changes and transformation and allowing people to move on and do and be more confident and do other things and just to get on with their life and make some changes. I think it's amazing. That
Lauren, you're saying you don't use hypnotherapy yet. Yes, you do.
Indirectly.
You don't indirectly. How much?
Yeah, it's true, indirectly. I mean, in fact, I know that, you know, as I'm learning hypnotherapy now,
I do that.
It's true. It's like even, you know, like when we all dwell in the people who are driving, we are sometimes in trance because we just can't remember from we've been A to B and you just drove from and suddenly, oh, I don't remember passing that, or you know, I've done it because we go into automatic.
And what you're learning now is learning to put language to whatever you're already doing. You know, we are all hypnotherapists, actually. You know, we are all watching behavior. We're all getting rapport with each other. We're all communicating. We go into trance every 7 or 8 minutes. And, you know, it's about learning how to use stories, metaphor, you know, and
that's true.
And it's about timing, it's about pacing and leading. You know, you're a phobia and fear specialist. You're using hypnotherapy.
Yeah, indirectly. Indirectly. But it's true. People have seen the wrong idea of hypnotherapy because they may have seen use it in the wrong way in films and stage. And yeah, and that's why. But indirectly, yes, we do. We go in and out subconscious mind all the time without even realizing. But I guess what we've seen on TV, on stage, is just can scare people and thinking, okay, I don't want you to control my mind or things like that.
Belief is we are all hypnotized already. Mm-hmm. And what a hypnotherapist is doing is unhypnotizing you.
It's true, actually. It's true because people don't even realize, even when you watch, especially when you're watching TV, there could be some background advertising just going into your mind and you don't even realize, and then you just go and get it because you've seen it, or it's in your subconscious mind, and it's just
We are all hypnotized by the news, by you know our parents, what they say to us, by our teachers, by advertising, by the media, I mean, I worked in the media. I know how this works. Yeah. So, I mean, we are all hypnotized at some level. Some people, and also depending on your personality, you could either be, you know, what we call a somnambulist type of personality. And a somnambulist is one of the sort of the 10% of the population who will basically just do everything that they're told, right? So they are the people that the stage hypnotists will pick, you know, so they do a lot of suggestibility tests to find 10% of that group. So say there's 200 people in the audience, there's definitely going to be around 20 people who are somnambulists. So how do you find those people? Well, you do different types of suggestibility tests to make it part of the show, to make it look entertaining. Mm-hmm. But now you've got, oh, that person over there and that person over there. I'm going to pick one of those people because they're going to make my show look good.
Definitely, it's true.
They're not randomly picking
someone. No, they're not. But a lot of people don't even realize when you don't realize and you're not aware of the language, you just don't even realize that it's actually set up and you've already agreed on certain things and subconsciously without even realizing. In fact, there was one soap, and they did put something in the background in every scene of advertising, and then they realized later on that people wanted that special thing that they put in the background. It was actually a credit card from a bank, and they need to step to increase of using that specific bank because every scene had that little thing in the background, you know, scene of restaurant or anything. It was just like, so people don't even realize that it goes into your mind and then it just, you sort of go and it's not randomly, you go and get and we'll go into that bank and just ask for that card.
And it sticks, and also it sticks when we're in a high arousal state, it sticks even more. So think about football stadiums, you know, before when there were people in the crowd, and you know, the football match is happening here in the middle with the, you know, on the grass or whatever, and then around the edge of the stadium there's flashing adverts.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? And because the people watching the match are in a high arousal state, whether it's excitement or whether it's sadness because they've lost or they're losing, whatever it is, it's those flashing adverts are doing their thing, right? And they're going to get
it. I guess it's true. And I guess if they are happy because they won, whatever they've seen around it, and they've saw it for probably 2 hours, and mm-hmm. and they've been fixing indirectly, they're going to associate the happiness and joy feeling with that. Whatever advertisement
exactly.
is, and they're going to go and want it because it's not just what it is, it's just not just the item, but it's the item connected with the emotion of happiness.
Exactly. So that's how exactly it works. And if you know that, then you can see it everywhere, right? And that's when we come in and we are hypnotherapists, not hypnotists. All right, we're using hypnosis, you know, but no one ever comes into my practice and says, you know what, today I'd really like to be turned into a chicken. You know, no one comes in and says that to me.
It's definitely what you said. It's to undo what has been subconsciously done without you knowing.
Yeah, because that, you know, they've had limiting beliefs being installed in, or they've had, as you know, fears and phobias installed in.
Yes.
We're not born with fears and phobias. We're not born with
them. No, I always said that to my clients, that if you're not born with it, there's no reason why you should have it the rest of your life.
Exactly. It's happened to you because of circumstances, or because your belief system has decided that this is important to hold on to, or your value system has decided it's important. So all we're doing is kind of shining a spotlight on those systems and kind of saying, you know, is this something you want in there, or do we want to perhaps do something else with it? You know, and it's like a computer, the brain, really.
Definitely.
It's definitely like a computer.
We have different, I always say it's like a computer, we have different software, and some software is serving us for X amount of time, and then it's no longer serving us, and we can just delete it and then put a different software, and then and then the changes happen.
Yeah, and also sometimes we get in, you know, viruses come in, you know, and attacking the system, right? Yeah. And in a computer in the brain, the same thing.
Overload.
Virus, yeah. And you get things where you've run out of space and then everything starts to shut down. So the brain is exactly like that. So you need to defrag it, don't you? You need to, you know, you need to clear out the cache. And also you need to create some more space for positives or useful, rather than not useful and junk, and things get duplicated. So we probably say exactly the same
thing. Different matters. But it's you know what, it's like when you use a new software, you can feel a little bit like clumsy or a bit worried that how to use a new software, and part of the healing is also like people are a bit scared of changes and what's going to happen and what's it going to be like, because sometimes they've been in fear for such a long time, and it has served them in certain ways because it's protection in certain ways. So so you can't just go in like this and take the fear away, because if it's connected to protection, well, they have no protection. But it's almost like, it's exactly like you said, like it's a computer and we have different software according to how we were born, and sometimes we even carry inherited emotions that we don't even know about, or that it doesn't even belong to us. And then we're just accessing the subconscious mind and we're changing that software. And sometimes it takes time, and sometimes you just have to say, well, you know, it's a new software. It's like using a new computer with a different app, and you just have to learn the process and get used to it. And
that's a really, really good way of describing it. And, you know, eventually we do adjust, don't we? And then we kind of forget what the old one looked like, you know.
Definitely. This is when I see people, I only have a form to fill in purely. It's not, the form is actually not even for me. It's for my clients, so that after I help them, I find that they kept on saying, oh, it wasn't so bad. Oh no, I wasn't scared of dogs so much. I didn't put myself in the street in danger or anything. And then I can take the file out. I can take the form out and say, actually,
this is what you've written
before we started.
And they look
like, oh wow, was that really like, because it's exactly what you're saying, when it's no longer in the subconscious mind, you just forget about it. You just, it's not in the software anymore. So you just don't think about it. Or they say, oh no, it wasn't that bad. Oh no, that wasn't me. It wasn't. And this is why, so what would you say to someone, especially now with the pandemic, what would you say to someone who is, you know, about to lose a loved one, especially the pandemic is so, it's different even, because I know, and probably for you too, that I was able to stay with my daughter for 12 days in intensive care. I was there all the time. I didn't even leave 1 minute. I was always there. But now this is even harder for people. They can't even be there. They can't even hold hands to their loved one right to the end. And looking back, I feel even privileged that I had that I was giving that privilege, that I could be with my daughter and be there all the time, right to the end. But this type of grief to me is going to be even, I mean, unbearable, because not even be able to see the person going.
I know.
Being it's there.
Awful. So tragic. And I, you know, and again, the same, I had the opportunity to be there for my loved ones as well. And I can't imagine what it would feel like if someone said, I'm sorry, you can't come in and you've got
to. I would just go in. I think
being illegal or wherever.
I know. I would want to go in.
But this is happening to people now.
And, I know.
And as you say, it is a new type of grieving that hasn't probably existed before, unless it has existed in other types of lifetimes before us, like in the war, or, you know, in other maybe scenarios which we haven't had in our experience. So it's very much to do with finding new ways. Now it's like a new upgrade, isn't it? So something
Unfortunately, it's even the funerals. I mean, you know, doing Zoom funerals. And I mean, I remember my daughter. For my daughter, we had 1,000 people turning up for her funeral. Wow. It's a completely exactly what you said. It's just unexpected. I mean, nobody ever thought that you couldn't be next to your loved one and being there, and even going and doing a funeral on Zoom. This is just unthinkable. And yeah, it's like you said, it's just a new sort of, I would say it's, or maybe we'll call it 2020 grief, a completely different way of unexpected, and it will have definitely other impact to have to deal with. I think because it's to have to deal with loss like this, it's something that needs to be addressed. I hope that maybe soon they'll let people, at least even if you wear all the PPP and everything, that you can just at least be allowed one person to go in to be with the loved one, because this is going to be, I mean, I can't even think about it, because having gone through grief the way we've gone through, this was so important for me to be with my daughter all the time.
And then also, how do you decide which one person gets to go, you know?
That's also, yeah.
And that in itself will cause so much upset and chaos within the family unit itself, you know, that. And so, I mean, weirdly enough, I was writing Planet Grief in the middle of the pandemic, right? So interestingly, I got a really interesting perspective. And obviously the pandemic, you know, I had when I started writing the book, there was no pandemic, no sight of pandemic. We never even heard of the word pandemic, probably, you know.
Yeah, it's not vaguely, but not, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't really part of our life. And then pandemic, and that was where I was writing the main body of the book. So obviously me and my editor had to include the pandemic now into the book. So in a really strange way, I was going through it and writing about it at the same time. So I found that extremely confusing in a way, because I was trying to find solutions to give to people in my book, but I couldn't find solutions because we were all going through it. And it's really difficult to take yourself so above the situation when you're in the situation to look at it abstractly or laterally when you're literally in it.
It's true, because and it was unexpected. I mean, it was unexpected, yeah. And it was just, yeah, so.
But now I've got a bit more of a distant perspective on what was happening then. So now I'm starting to think about, you know, how to cope with it, you know, what can we do? And actually, I think I just decided that you got to accept it's going to be difficult. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be painful.
You're right.
You're going to be angry. You're going to be
frustrated. It is about accepting. It is about sometimes you just can't fight everything.
Yeah.
You just have to surround yourself and let it go and just accept, okay, this is the way it is. Things have changed. And there will be an end at some point. We're not going to be in it for X amount of years. There will be a light at the end of the tunnel. But at the moment, you just have to sit back and just let it, you know, sort of like surround yourself in a way instead of fighting it, because you can't. It's not something that we can do. And it's all about saving life at the moment. So yeah. Dipti, thank you very much for sharing your your life and ideas and those mentioning your book. Where can our listeners find you?
So it's really easy, diptitaite.com. So diptiaite.com.
Thank you very much for today. And you're listening to Lauren Rosenberg, Fear Buster. And looking forward to seeing you next week talking about another fear. Have a lovely week. Bye.